Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 28th, 1999, and in Koinonia Fireside Room this evening is Bob and Gracie Ekblad in their last session, Life in El Norte, Perspective of the South.
If you can roll the tape there. This is our last session, and we're going to be talking about life in El Norte, perspectives from the South on immigrant issues here in North America. And I'm Bob Ekblad, and I'm with Rocio Robles from Mexico, who works with Tierra Nueva del Norte, and then David Calis and Celio Mejia from Tierra Nueva in Honduras. What we wanted to do today is just kind of give you an overview of what our ministry, what we're trying to do with immigrants in Skagit County, Washington, and some of the issues that we've discovered as we've worked with immigrants in this ministry. This is a picture of Mount Baker. It's actually Skagit County, Washington State, and in this county, like in many counties around the United States, there's large numbers of immigrants migrating there. This is an agricultural valley, and so there are lots and lots of jobs, especially during the months of harvest from May until October. Actually even earlier than that, there's the flower bulb season that begins in March when there's a lot of need for workers to go and cut the flowers and, in preparation so that the bulbs can, continue to develop properly and everything. Anyway, lots and lots of farm workers come in to do this seasonal work. Then in June you have strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, in June and July, and then cucumbers in August. That's happening right now as we speak. There's lots and lots of farm workers that are harvesting cucumbers. Then also from July until about October, you have broccoli and cauliflower harvesting. So we have about probably 15,000 immigrants living in our county right now, most of whom are working in meat processing plants, fruit processing plants, or out in the fields doing the hoeing and the harvesting. So anyway, this one of the questions that I want to ask you is, a lot of you guys have already been to some of our other presentations, and we've seen the situation of poverty in Central America. Immigration experts talk about push factors that are driving people to leave their countries to come to North America. What are some of the common push factors that you guys are aware of that would push someone to leave Honduras or Mexico, in particular Central America or Mexico, to come to North America?
Poverty.
Mm-hmm. Might be hope for a better tomorrow.
Okay, that's more of a pull factor, which we're going to talk about in a second. Hope would be like something that would be drawing you to come, right? But push factors are things that drive you. What's that? So typical.
The difference between the push and the pull factor.
One of the major push factors would be poverty.
Oppression,
exactly, like wars or political oppression.
The debts of poor countries and the accompanying conditions that are put on those countries by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund.
That make life difficult for the people, yeah.
Natural disasters.
Hurricane Mitch is a major push factor.
Well, probably no land to work, but that's related to the poverty issue.
Yes, landlessness, definitely.
Okay, it's also related to the debt.
Yeah.
So anyway, right now we have a massive movement of people from the Southern Hemisphere into the Northern Hemisphere, and that's happening in Europe, and it's happening in the United States. In Europe you have many people from North Africa and all over Africa that are coming into Europe. And you have in North America a massive movement of people from Mexico and Central America into the United States. So pull factors would be the other things that immigration experts talk about. And the major number one pull factor would be jobs. In Honduras, we talk with every time I go there, people are asking me, "Well, is it true? People make $5.50 an hour." And I say, "Well, yeah, that's the minimum wage, $5.50, $5.70 an hour." And they just roll their eyes and they can't believe it. That just seems like so much money compared to $1, $1.50 a day, which is the daily wage in Honduras. And so people just figured it out really quickly. Well, 40 hours a week or 60 hours a week, that's so much money. And, you know, and of course the dollars go further in Honduras than they do.
Do you tell them that?
Yes. Oh, yeah, we talk about that. So jobs would be the number one pull factor. The other would be family. You know, you getting reunited with family that is up in North America already. Another would be better opportunities for education for your children. You know, the opportunity to come and learn, have your kids learn English and go through the school system. You know, better medical attention, maybe. So anyway, those are the typical pull factors. So that, there's a lot of pull factors that have drawn people into the Skagit Valley, and number one would be jobs. Oops, that's kind of blurry. These are a bunch of farm workers. This is a group of farm workers that are out planting strawberries. In our particular area, we have farm workers from probably half or two-thirds of the farm workers are from Oaxaca, Mexico, so they're Indians that speak Mixteco or Triqui. And anyway, these people come in and there's almost immediately jobs available for them, especially mainly during the harvesting season or planting season. But one of the questions is, how do you get to know people, you know, who are working in the fields, you know, day and night? I mean, a lot of the people, you know, that are out there harvesting, these people are working sometimes 7 days a week, or oftentimes 7 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day. And, you know, they're working long, long hours. And, you know, our ministry wanted to reach out and to meet these people. And so what we discovered was one of the only ways to really do it was to go out and to work side by side with the people. And so I began doing that and initiated some relationships, you know, through just going out with the farmer's permission and sort of meeting people or working alongside them. And the closer I got to people, the more trust was built. Myself as a gringo, you know, as a gabacho, they call us, and the Mexicans call us, there was a lot of distrust in the beginning because, you know, the Border Patrol has been very active in our area and people are afraid. You know, they're very fearful. And it's more in the last few years, you know, 3 years ago, 5 years ago than now. But there's immediate distrust just because of my race and, you know, education and, you know, I mean, the color of my skin, whatever, my language, my nationality. And then when you add the fact that I'm not a Roman Catholic to it, you know, there's even more distrust. But as we got to know people little by little, we got, you know, closer and closer and began to make friends with people. And it's friendship, really, that is the basis of any kind of ministry. And another thing that happened is we got involved with some of the growers and the farm workers because the INS would do raids. Like this pumpkin operation was raided. You know, this happened several times. The INS has come in with 25, 30 agents and all with dogs and with a helicopter flying overhead to spot people that might be running through the fields. And they go in and they just grab people and they, you know, they bring them into an office, you know, where they check everyone's papers to see if they're who's legal and who's not legal. And the people that are, it's decided that they're illegal are thrown into the vans and taken up to Bellingham where they're, you know, put under arrest and processed. And then they're shipped down to Seattle where they're put in detention for maybe a day or maybe as long as a week before they're put on buses, sometimes handcuffed to the rails of the bus and driven for several days down to the Mexican border and dropped off. You know,
dropped off at the border?
Dropped off in Mexico, yeah.
But not returned to their homes?
Oh, no, not at all. No, just dropped off at the border and with wearing whatever they're wearing. I mean, I know of cases where people wearing Kentucky Fried Chicken uniforms were deported down to Ciudad Juarez. You know, and they weren't given a chance to collect their belongings or you know, maybe they were given the chance, but the rest of the family was undocumented, and so they were afraid to go and bring the belongings to their family member in the jail, you know, in the INS detention facility, and with reason, because they'd be arrested there. So anyway, that's got us involved in working side by side with the, you know, with some of the growers who were affected and with the farm workers, which we'll talk about later. Another way that we've gotten to know farm immigrants has been through the jail. I work as chaplain of Skagit County Jail, and about the first week that we moved to Mount Vernon, you know, we moved up there to try to start a ministry because we saw that there was only one full-time pastoral worker in this whole community of 15,000 farm workers and immigrants, and that was the Catholic priest. He was the only full-time person, and he was in charge of other English Anglo parishes and had other duties besides the Spanish services too. So, I mean, there was no mainline Protestant ministry of any kind. You know, maybe the churches were supporting food banks and things, but there was no direct ministry and no ministry of word and sacrament. So what we saw was the Roman Catholic Church, which had a very strong mass and a very good priest. But then we had, in terms of evangelicals, it was just really fundamentalist groups, mostly Jesus-only groups that wouldn't recognize anyone, and you know, any of you as believers or any of us, unless you were baptized in the name of only Jesus. So if you were baptized, you know, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you had to be rebaptized in order to be considered saved. You know, so that was a very divisive sort of group. But really, it's those two extremes.
Now, these are federal prisoners. They let you in? Because in some, they don't.
This is a jail, a county jail.
A county jail, but they may be, if they're on a federal charge of immigration, no, they're, some county jails, they won't even let anybody in anyway because they're federal prisoners.
Well, that's right. There's Border Patrol holds, and some jails might not let someone see someone who's held by the Border Patrol.
I've had my experience in trying to see somebody who, you know, the feds, no way. It was a county jail.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, in this jail, there's probably, when I first started working, I was asked by a local jail board to serve as chaplain to the Hispanic element in the jail, which was about 25% of 180 average, you know, inmate population. So that involved going and doing two weekly Bible studies in Spanish, one on Sunday night, or Thursday night, one on Sunday. And based on that Bible study, people that wanted one-on-one visitation, people would sign up to be visited, and I'd visit them one-on-one and do pastoral counseling. And then after about 3 months of doing that, the chaplain of the Anglos, he retired. So the jail board asked me to take on the whole job of jail chaplain, which was just a one-quarter time job, but which could be a full-time job. It's a huge job. So anyway, that's been a place where, probably been the place where, you know, if I'm frustrated about not being able to do direct ministry outside the jail, you know, there's so much that can be done with inmates that it's, you know, I could dedicate all my time in terms of my ministry as pastor to migrant farm workers just in the jail. There's so much to be done. You know, these inmates find themselves just in deep trouble, you know, a lot of times for things that they didn't even know were crimes. You know, a lot of immigrants are completely ignorant, or, you know, not completely ignorant, but often, well, completely ignorant of some laws. And they end up, you know, being jailed with charges, you know, sometimes very serious charges, and they don't understand how our system works. You know, they get a public defender assigned to them, but they think the public defender, they can't trust the public defender because the public defender receives county money, and so they're thinking about Mexico and, you know, and thinking how can this, what's, you know, they don't understand that idea of state providing a defense. So they oftentimes don't cooperate with public defenders, and they end up getting very bad deals in terms of plea bargains. And so anyway, what I do is I accompany these inmates and then get to know a lot of the inmates well enough so that they'll say, well, can you visit my wife and my kids? My wife, you know, she's in this apartment and she has no work and she's pregnant and we have four kids. And, you know, I don't know, there's a lot of, you know, my wife Gracie and I, we get involved visiting inmates and Rocio also. We have a family support center that we've set up where we distribute clothing. And we have office hours every day. And a lot of people come with just all kinds of needs. And a lot of those are people from the jail. Sometimes, you know, people are, like this woman, her husband was sentenced to 12 years in prison. And she was pregnant when he was sentenced, you know, for a very serious crime. And so she had no, you know, no papers and no job. And, you know, she had to quit her job. She worked all the way until she was, you know, like, the day before she delivered, you know, but then for a couple months after she couldn't go back to work because she had this little infant, and she had to find a place to live, and you know, so we provide a lot of support to people like her. You know, then there's other people that end up being released from the jails who, you know, who have all kinds of issues and needs. You know, some of them have serious problems with drugs. You know, I mean, and people, actually most of the people we meet through the jail ministry never contact us after they get out of jail. And that's because many go to prison, and then after that they're deported. You know, but even the ones that get out get released into the community. Some of them are, they're only, their whole network is a network of people that are drug dealers and drug users, and they end up falling back into, you know, the same old life, and I end up seeing them in jail, sometimes over and over and over again, until maybe they do something serious enough to go to prison. But there are people that come to us, and usually by the time they come to us, they have so many problems that there's a lot of work to be done. You know, we've had numerous families that, one particular situation, there's both the man, husband and the wife, or the man and the woman, they're not married. They want to be married, but she has no identification of any kind. She was born in a poor neighborhood in Tijuana, Mexico, but her mother never registered her, so she has no official Mexican nationality. And she came across the border when she was a little infant, like 3 months old. And she was raised here her whole life, but her mother never got herself legalized or her daughter legalized. And so her daughter never had any kind of identification. And once she was stopped by the Border Patrol and they asked, where were you born? She said, Mexico. And she didn't have a green card, so they deported her. Now she's been deported. But she was deported to a country that wasn't, that where there was no records of her. So a job that I have, still I haven't figured out how to do this, is how to get her identification. Because she wants to get married and get a driver's license and things like that, but she has no identification. And we end up with problems like that to solve, you know, and they're just different every week. Another issue is the Border Patrol. You know, I was mentioning earlier about how the INS does raids and will surround, you know, fish processing plants or meat packing plants or, you know, usually places like where they process like the pumpkins or process berries. They were surrounding for the first 3 or 4 years of our work, first 3 years, on a regular basis, they were surrounding places of employment and rounding people up. And we would get calls in the next couple of days from schools where a school teacher would say, hey, I got these two kids that they went home and there was no one home. So they came back to the school crying and their mom was deported. Do you know what we should do with these kids? You know, or we go and we find a dad whose wife was deported, leaving him with some infant that was like still nursing, you know, and just many, many situations like that. So our ministry developed, and then we hear stories of Border Patrol agents, you know, groping at women inappropriately and, you know, or beating people. And so we developed what we call the Skagit-Whatcom INS Watch Group, which is a network of volunteers who are willing to be trained to go and be present during raids. And we set up a network of telephone, you know, we let everyone know about our INS Watch Group and let all the employers know and let all the farm workers know through our newspaper, which we basically started this newspaper to communicate to people about their rights as immigrants, you know, because there was so much abuse on the part of the INS. Anyway, we promoted this very strongly, and we ended up organizing a network of people that to be trained to handle a video camera and to go and to politely say to the INS, well, we're here to monitor everything you do. We're going to be videotaping your actions here in this facility, and we're not here to stop you. We know you have a legal right. We assume you have a warrant, you know, to search warrant or whatever, raid warrant. And so, but we're going to film this because we want to minimize any kind of problems. And this is as much for their, it's mainly for the people's protection, but, you know. So anyway, we started that, and then we let the INS know we were doing this. And we organized meetings with the border heads of the Border Patrol and with the INS, and where we brought growers and INS agents and Border Patrol agents together, so that the farm workers together who were documented, who could speak on behalf of their people. And that ended up leading to the Border Patrol chief coming and saying, basically, don't tell anyone, he says, that I say this, but we've decided to not do any more raids. So we were pretty excited about that. So there have been 2 years now without raids.
Good work. Mm-hmm. Is there any way that an illegal immigrant can change their status to a legal immigrant after they get here?
Well, there are ways. It's a very complicated thing. We have an expert behind you who works as the Associate Director of Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, Leah. That's probably the strongest group, advocacy group for immigrants in Washington, in the Northwest. And, you know, there, you guys are backed up. You know, I mean, there's so much work to be done. People need legal expertise, you know. And it's expensive to get hire an immigration attorney who can help you figure out, you know, whether you even have a hope of getting legalized and then to take you through the processes. You know, a lot of the people we work with are semi-literate. I mean, they're peasants, and they don't speak English, and they don't, so they can't read English, and and even Spanish they have difficulty with. I mean, some of these Indians from Oaxaca, their first language is Mixteco or Creek. You know, so to take someone through the process of getting all their papers in order and applying, assuming that they can qualify, is a lot of work. But most of the people can't qualify.
Right. That's a real minority of people.
It's
qualify for independent at all.
And what could qualify them?
If they've been here, if they have family members who are legal and they're still at an age where they're, where they're like their mom or dad, or they're not married and they're like under 21, or maybe they're a spouse of someone who's here who has the papers. But now there's a law that says that if you haven't applied before 1997, you have to go back to Mexico and stay for 5 years before you can apply. And if you've been 10 years, if you've been here more than a year, and 5 years, if you've been here less than a year, illegally. So there's like a punishment for anyone that's been here. So, I mean, that completely cuts off the possibilities for millions, I don't know how many people, hundreds of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm. And that little baby that you showed now is a U.S. citizen.
U.S. citizen.
And should qualify for WIC and all the other government benefits.
Definitely, yes. But a lot of those benefits have been cut back, in recent years. And so, but, that is a help to a lot of families. So anyway, the INS continues to be a difficulty, and one of the greatest difficulties is police and law enforcement agents who will come, like, into a migrant camp. Like last year, they went into a migrant camp and break up a fight, and they told the people, they said, oh, I bet all you guys are a bunch of illegals anyway. If I have any more problems here, I'll call the Border Patrol. Well, the people just understood Border Patrol, and as soon as he left, they all fled into the fields, and, half, three-quarters of the people in the camp didn't show up for work the next day. It's about 500 people that worked in that camp. Okay, because people are terrified. And so because law enforcement agents are increasingly associated with the INS, most immigrants will not call the police when they need help. So you have this huge percentage of the population, in Mount Vernon it's probably 35%, 40% of the population maybe, that have no police protection, unless they're really desperate and they're willing to run the risk of being deported or whatever, So anyway, there are ways to cooperate with the INS. I mean, to get them to cooperate with us, I work pretty closely with the Border Patrol and INS. And at times, like in this case, a family, the husband of one of these women was caught in the jail, ended up in the jail because of a warrant for an unpaid traffic ticket. And the Border Patrol, they put holds on people within about 8 hours or 6 hours. And so that person had to do a little bit of time in the jail, but then he was deported. Or he was told he had a deportation date, he was going to leave the next week. So I asked the family whether, they had no way of driving down to Mexico. They were at the end of the season, they were going to go back to Mexico anyway. And this one of the girls who didn't even have a driver's license and hardly could drive, she says, well, I do kind of know how to drive. I could drive us down to Mexico. And I said, I'd hate to see you guys get in an accident. Would you be open, if I could get you a free trip with your husband, with the INS, would you be willing to go? And they said, no. And I said, well, think about it. And so they came back to me and they said, yes. And I said, well, let me see whether I can make sure that they don't have to fingerprint you guys and put you into the system. So I called them and I said, I can have all this family that will turn themselves in if you can get them assured that they get a ride back with their husband who's going to be deported. But they don't want to be fingerprinted. Can you assure me of that? What can you say to that? And they agreed. So I've done that two or three times. And that's, they consider that, then they kind of owe me a favor, the Border Patrol. So at times I've gotten the Border Patrol to release people from jail where there were holds on them because of the current laws. So we're working, trying to stay in a good relationship. Another thing we're trying to do is just raise awareness among the Anglo community about farm worker issues. And one of the ways we do that is through organizing migrant camp improvement projects, where we'll bring churches. This summer we had 25 churches that were involved from Western Washington. And these churches will come in and maybe build a basketball court or a covered picnic area or paint all the migrant camps before the workers come. And, we try to get the growers to pay for all the expenses, all the materials. So it's a way to get the growers, to help the growers improve conditions for the people and also give churches direct contact with the farm workers and the farmers. So we're trying to create partnerships between farm workers, farmers, and churches to improve the living situation for the workers. But for us, the heart of our whole ministry is trying to develop friendships of trust. And, you know, and it's these friendships that are really the basis for people, you know, coming into our office and getting involved in our other part of our work, which is, you know, we would hope that they would meet God as a God who is for them and who loves them and have a transformation of their image of God, you know, from a negative image of God, you know, which we've talked about in past talks. You know, God is distant judge, you know, kind of white, severe, bearded kind of guy way out there. You know, God is INS chief, you know, and the church is border patrol agents and law enforcement agents. I mean, that's how the average immigrant sees Christianity, right? And we're trying to transform that image of God. And the way we do that is through getting involved in the lives of people, so that, you know, we, in a way, we're bearers of this, of a different word, you know, and yet we're coming in humility, hoping to hear something from them as well. And it's been a great pleasure for us to get to know people. And our Bible study group, we started with two people, and then probably went down to one, and then went up to two, you know, for I think 2 or 3 years, and it was like Rocio, Gracie, and I, you know, Rocio and Roger. And we were just like meeting every Sunday, and we'd invite people, and people would come 1 week, and then they'd never come again, and very, very slow process. And now we're up to about, you know, if everyone came, we maybe have 70 or 80 people, I don't know, if everyone came. But it's been a very slow process to develop a kind of our worshiping community, which is slow, I mean, which is slowly happening. But one of the ways that we do that is just through meeting people at their point of felt needs, you know, and that's the entry level to building trust. And one of the ways we've done that is we have a farming project, a collective farming project. This year we have 7 acres, or 8 acres, and we have 14 families that, where we divided up the 8-acre plot, and there's 7 acres that are for corn, and then 1 acre for a collective vegetable garden. So, or actually the 1 acre is divided into seven sections, and there's 2 families on each section. So that's a way for farmers to grow produce, and then what we do is we sell the produce in churches in the fall. So when we go back, we're going to be busy organizing presentations where we come into a church on Sunday morning with a farm worker family with all their corn and produce, and we set up a table at the exit to the church, entrance to the church, and people will, you know, will buy the produce and have a direct contact with the farm worker. This is where we have our gatherings, our Sunday evening Bible studies, and we have a lay pastor training program on Wednesdays. This we have about 7 folks that are part of that. This is one of the migrant camp improvement projects, building a basketball court. We have migrant Bible schools. This year there were migrant Bible schools in 7 out of the 8 migrant camps in our county. And we don't call them vacation Bible schools because these people aren't on vacation. You know, we call them migrant Bible schools, and we've been training the churches to know how to, you know, carry on something like that that's sensitive to the culture. And that's been an ongoing process. This is selling the produce in the fall in a church. At the end of a migrant Bible school. One of our objectives really is to get the churches into direct contact with the people, and the people with the churches. Because if the church is the body of Christ, well, that body has been absent from this community, you know, in many ways. At least the majority of the church folks in our county have had very little direct contact with this population. So oftentimes in a meeting we'll invite, we'll have the last night we'll have a big fiesta and we'll invite the whole migrant camp, and the migrants will invite all the migrant farm workers to stand up, and then we'll give them a big applause and official thanks for all their work harvesting the county's, you know, vegetables. And people are very touched by that, you know, these farm workers who often feel like they're just they're hated, really, and they're anyway, I'd like to just invite Rocio to share a little bit about some of the obstacles to, communicating good news to the farm worker population.
nosotros tratamos de trabajar fuerte con la gente, con nuestra con mi gente, pues.
We try to work in a strong way with our people.
Pero hay barreras tan difíciles.
But there are barriers that are so difficult.
Empezando por esas imágenes tan perversas que traen desde México sobre Dios.
Beginning with the very perverse images of God that they bring up from Mexico about.
Es muy difícil trabajar con gente así.
It's very, very difficult to work with people
in this pero pues, who have this image of God. ¿Verdad?
But we try to do that.
Otra de las cosas que también es un gran obstáculo es la desconfianza.
Another thing that's a great obstacle is the distrust.
En México, la Iglesia Católica tiene una campaña permanente contra las iglesias evangélicas, que son las que más.
In Mexico, the Catholic Church has a permanent campaign against the evangelical churches, which are
entonces,
what are most often,
pero,
most common.
Pero la Iglesia Católica especifica que todos son protestantes.
But the Catholic Church specifies that all of these churches are Protestant churches.
Son protestantes, por lo tanto, uno llega aquí a Estados Unidos y si no es la Iglesia Católica,
and so we come to the United States
and
people,
sectas.
If it's not the Catholic Church, every other church is considered a sect.
Entonces, la gente es sumamente desconfiada.
So people are very distrustful.
Hay muchos testigos de Jehová.
There are many Jehovah's Witnesses.
Tocan a la puerta,
that knock on the door, and they insist a lot.
Y se enojan. La
and
gente
people
se enoja,
get upset.
Se molesta.
They're bothered by that.
Entonces, cuando se trata de ayuda de iglesias, mucha gente tiene desconfianza.
So when it comes to help from churches, they have a lot of distrust and they don't want to go.
Una de las cosas que hemos hecho es que nosotros pues siempre estamos ahí dispuestos a cualquier cosa, ¿verdad?
One of the things that we do is that we're always there ready to help in whatever way.
Siempre están buscando a los pastores que necesitan ayuda con que problemas con la policía.
People come to the looking for the pastors looking for help about dealing with the police or dealing with immigration.
Y no se les dice nada sobre Dios, absolutamente.
And the pastors don't tell them anything about God.
Hay familias,
and that's a way to build trust, right?
Familias completas que van a un estudio bíblico.
There are entire families that come to the Bible study.
Por solo una vez.
Maybe they come just one time.
No regresan.
And then they don't return.
Es difícil.
It's very difficult.
Es difícil ver a la gente que regrese, pero lo curioso es
hard to see the people when they don't come back.
Como siempre está uno abierto a ayudar.
But when we're always open
regresa.
To help, then people return.
Cuando tiene problemas.
When they have problems.
Y siempre regresan.
And they always return. They always come back.
Y últimamente yo he visto que esas personas.
And lately, a lot of these people.
Que siempre se les han ayudado.
Who we've always
ayudado
been helping, helping resolve their problems.
Últimamente.
Most
han
recently,
ido
they've been coming a lot more to the Bible studies.
Entonces parece que nuestro trabajo, pues.
So it seems like our work
va lento, pero.
It goes slowly, but.
Está dando frutos.
But we're seeing fruits.
Muchas veces esa misma gente tiene interés de ir, pero.
Many times people are interested in coming.
Por ejemplo, en la época del pepino.
But in the period of the harvest of the cucumber.
Ese producto se paga por a destajo.
This product is paid for according to how much you harvest.
Entonces la gente se levanta al amanecer.
People wake up at the crack of dawn.
Se lleva a toda su familia.
They bring their whole family out. Fields.
Y regresa del campo, trabaja lunes, de lunes a domingo.
And they come back to late at night and they work from Monday until Sunday.
Y regresa ya tarde.
And they
ya
come back late.
Cuando está oscureciendo.
When it's already getting dark.
Porque es cuando más dinero hacen.
Because that's when they make the most amount of money, is when the cucumber.
Entonces, es la época en que más gente hay.
And that's the period when there's the most amount of people.
Menos, a veces llega
and that's when people come the least to the Bible study. So right now we would normally be having it in a half an hour, but we've canceled it for tonight because we're here, and also because people are busy.
También hay otro problema que hay que mucha gente no tiene vehículos.
And many people don't have cars.
O son familias tan grandes.
Or the people that have such big families.
Que tienen un carro pequeño para que
one little tiny car,
vayan a trabajar los
so
más grandes.
So that some of the older people can go work.
Y la familia, toda la familia no cabe
but
en
the whole family, they don't fit into the little car.
Entonces, muchas veces Roberto va por alguna familia
so
o dos familias.
Roberto will go and pick up a couple of families that live in the same place.
Para llevarlo al estudio bíblico.
To bring him to the Bible study.
Hay otro, un hombre que nos ayuda ahí que se llama Roger.
There's another person that, who's called named Roger who helps us.
También a veces va por gente.
Sometimes he goes to pick up people or sometimes people call me.
En fin, pero mucha gente a veces no tiene medio.
But many people don't have ways to travel, come to the Bible study.
Otra de las cosas, dos cosas, muchas veces la gente como no tiene papeles.
Another thing is a lot of people, since they don't have papers.
O hay gente que no tiene licencia.
Or people that don't have driver's licenses.
Se atreven a manejar para ir a trabajar.
They'll take the risk to drive their car when they have to go to work.
O a veces el amigo es el que tiene licencia y es el que maneja su carro.
Sometimes maybe a friend who has a license, they're the ones that drive their car.
Así que es un terror para salir a
so
la tienda.
So they're scared to go out to a store.
Ni para solo para comprar comida.
Maybe they would just go to buy food and they're frisky.
Porque tienen miedo.
And they're afraid to do that. A lot of fear to go and find
a la migra,
run into the border patrol.
O que la policía los pare.
Or that the police would stop them for whatever.
Son los obstáculos.
These are obstacles, the biggest obstacle.
Fuertes que tenemos nosotros. Para poder trabajar.
Y la gente tomando en los campos.
Claro. Desde luego los vicios.
Another problem is vices and drinking.
Mucha gente, yo conozco mujeres.
I know women.
Que llegan tan cansadas.
Who come so tired, from the fields here in Wenatchee and in Burlington too.
He visto mujeres que se envician porque llegan tan cansadas de trabajar
who become addicts to alcohol.
Que empiezan a tomar cerveza.
Because they come so tired from work, they begin to drink a beer. They'll drink a beer.
Y eso las relaja y.
And that relaxes them.
Y así empiezan con
And that's how it begins. They begin with having a problem.
Las drogas también.
And drugs also.
Hay personas que, pues, también consumen drogas.
There are people that use drugs.
Entonces, esos son los. Sobre todo con las personas que a veces salen de la cárcel. Muchas personas que han salido de la cárcel llegan al estudio bíblico, empiezan a ir.
Many times people who come from the jail, they will come to the Bible study and they begin to come.
Pero cuando nosotros sabemos que cuando dejan de ir es que sabemos
but when
que
they stop coming, then we know
they've
begun again to use the drugs.
O andar tomando.
Or to begin drinking. I oftentimes am given someone's beeper number, and when they get out of jail, I'll call them, and they'll immediately call me, and we'll set up a meeting and meet. And then a couple days later, I'll call them on the beeper number, and they'll call me back, and they'll forget who they're calling, and they'll think I'm someone wanting to buy drugs. And then when they find out it's me, they feel all embarrassed, and then I don't hear from him again until I see him in jail. It's really sad. Yo no sé si ustedes ahora quieren hablar un poquito de sus impresiones. I wanted to ask these men to talk about their impressions. They've both been working as chaplains in one of the migrant camps. We've invited these two men and a third man who just left because his son was diagnosed with aplastic anemia down in Honduras. But they've been here they'll be here for 3 months total. And a local farmer has been paying their food and they're giving them lodging in exchange for them working with our ministry as chaplains in this one migrant camp where there have been a lot of problems with people, partying and fighting and things like that. And he was thinking that maybe this would help, the presence of, pastoral workers from Tierra Nueva might help him with some of his labor problems too. Anyway, they're going to share some of their views of life in El Norte. Ustedes ahora pueden hablar un poco de sus impresiones de la vida de los inmigrantes aquí en El Norte. Y después vamos a terminar hablando de las cómo alcanzamos las barreras, cómo qué hacemos para.
Sí, uno de los objetivos nuestros de venir acá.
One of our objectives in coming here.
Es porque como nosotros trabajamos con campesinos en Honduras.
It's because since we work with peasants in Honduras.
Y allá hay una fiebre para venir acá.
And there's a fever to come up here to the United States.
Y a veces tal vez llegan a triunfar un 10%.
And what we see is that maybe 10% of the people are able to succeed when their plans to come here. 90% of the people end up completely submerged in their problems.
A veces en las cárceles aquí,
sometimes in jails here,
o en las drogas,
or involved in drugs,
o regresan,
or they're sent back, and they end up coming back to Honduras worse than they came here.
Y yo he observado una cosa, solo con una persona he platicado en Honduras, que dice que es mejor quedarse en Honduras para un campesino y no venir al norte.
And I've talked to only one person in Honduras who told me that it's better for a campesino to stay in Honduras and not come to North America.
Pero los otros amigos que estábamos platicando con él,
but everyone else who's talking to him, the other friends, they got mad at him.
Y dijo que era egoísta.
And said he was egotistical.
Dijeron que era egoísta, que no quisieran, que no quería que
ellos. He didn't want them to come up and benefit from being up here.
Nosotros no podemos hablarle a la gente allá.
We can't talk to the people from experience.
Nuestra venida acá es para conocer la realidad.
One of our reasons for coming here is to get to know the reality.
Lo poco que hemos estado,
and the little that we've been here,
estado viviendo en un campo,
we've been living in a camp, Sukuma micro camp, number two.
Es una empresa grandísima.
This is a big, agricultural enterprise, a company.
Y tiene más de 400 trabajadores.
They have more than 400 workers.
Entonces, ahí hemos observado que no es como dicen.
And we've observed that it's not like they say down in Honduras.
Es bien difícil la vida acá en el norte.
It's very difficult, the life here in the north.
Porque no es que hay trabajo.
It's not that there's
porque
so much work.
Tantas personas a veces solo trabajan hora y media en el día.
There's so many workers right now that sometimes people will only work an hour and a half during a day.
Y cuando llegan no tienen casa.
And when people come here from the south, they don't have houses.
Muchas veces hemos observado personas en la oficina de Tierra Nueva.
Many times we've seen people in the office of Tierra Nueva.
Buscando el ministerio para que les consiga casa.
Looking for help to get housing.
Llegan sin comida.
They come without food.
Sin ropa.
Without clothing.
Entonces, pero vaya, tan siquiera el ministerio de Tierra Nueva está haciendo un poquito por esa gente.
But at least Tierra Nueva is doing something a little bit for
pero
these people.
Cuando esa gente viene a otros lados,
but when these people go to other places,
son grandes los problemas que sufren.
The problems they have are very great.
Una de las cosas que estamos viendo es la dependencia del vehículo aquí para el transporte.
One of the things we're seeing is the dependence. People are totally dependent upon cars to be able to work.
El hondureño no viene preparado para manejar.
Hondurans come here and they're not ready to they're not prepared to drive.
Otra de las cosas es el idioma.
And the other problem is the language.
Y hemos observado también que llegan muchos inmigrantes que al primer pago que sacan.
And we've seen that many immigrants come and when the first paycheck they get.
Toman toda la noche.
They drink all night long.
Porque nosotros estamos en el centro del campo.
Because we're in the center of the migrant camp, living there.
Y ha habido veces que venimos a dormir un poquito a las 4 de la mañana.
And there have been times when we haven't been able to sleep, maybe just a little bit, starting at like 4 in the morning.
Aunque estemos acostados.
Even though we're laying there.
Pero gritos por aquí.
But there's cries,
llanto por allá.
Yelling.
Con música por todos lados.
Music everywhere.
Entonces es un molote, como decimos
so there,
nosotros.
It's just a mess. That's what we say in Honduras, molote.
Otro día amanecen golpeados.
And the next day they're all beaten up.
Con enemistades, porque en el campo Sakuma hay grandes enemistades.
With conflicts between other people. Right now there are major conflicts between people, between the immigrants themselves.
A veces, y también, no solo los varones, sino mujeres.
And not just between men, but sometimes the men, women are drinking day and night too.
Entonces, para nosotros es un gran problema.
So for us, this is a big problem.
Porque aunque ellos son inmigrantes mexicanos, pero nosotros sabemos que los hondureños, la mayoría, vienen a lo mismo acá también.
Because even though they're immigrants from Mexico, we know that the majority of Hondurans come to the same situation.
Y también, en cuanto, si le parece el pago.
And if the pay is something they're in agreement with,
agárralo, si no vayas,
they take it, and otherwise get out of here. That's what the company says.
If
you're not satisfied with your pay, well, then go.
Hay grandes problemas.
So there's big problems between the farm workers and the growers.
Otra de los problemas que miro yo es en cuanto a los niños.
Another problem that I see is with the children.
El día de semana,
during the week,
llega un bus A
bus comes at 5 in the morning every day of the week. And they take all the children away.
The
kids are all crying because they've been woken up at 5 in the morning. And they're crying because they don't want to be separated from their moms. Sometimes they're taken, but they're hanging under the mother's blouse. And the mother's forcing them to go into the bus.
Entonces, nosotros siempre. A veces nos levantamos.
Sometimes we get up
para observar a los
just
niños
to watch the children.
Ellos nos despiertan a nosotros
because they wake us up from their crying.
Entonces, los levantamos, entonces ya miramos que están despachando los niños para poder
get up and
trabajar.
We see them dispatching the children.
La mamá
so that the mom can work and the dad also.
Sí, porque si solo trabaja uno,
because if just one works,
no hay los suficientes ingresos.
They're not able to make enough money to live.
Entonces, estamos viendo una gran desintegración en la familia.
So we're seeing a lot of disintegration of the family.
En la tarde llega tipo 5 de la tarde.
In the afternoon, the kids come at 5 in the morning to be left off. 5 in the afternoon to be left off.
Otra de las cosas que observé.
Another thing that
un trabajador inmigrante
one
en
immigrant worker
me dijo,
told me.
Aquí los gringos pecan, dice.
Here are the gringos, they sin.
¿Por qué le digo yo?
Said,
nos obligan a trabajar el domingo.
They force us to work on Sundays.
Él es de una iglesia.
He's from a church.
Entonces no podía ir.
But he can't go to church.
Porque si iba a la iglesia, entonces
if he goes to
perdía,
church, and
parece que $15.
He loses $15. Like
entonces,
a fine or whatever.
Aparte de que no le reconocían el día, le sacaban
in addition
más,
to not being able to be paid for that day, he's fined $15.
Entonces, las personas que tienen alguna intención de asistir a las iglesias,
so people that have a desire to go to a church,
se ven, ¿cómo se llama? Obstaculizadas.
There's an obstacle there for them.
Por las compañías.
The companies put an obstacle up for them to go.
Entonces, porque a veces no permiten, aunque sea 2-3 horas trabajan.
Even if it's 2 or 3 hours, they don't permit it. They want them to work.
Y si no tienen que pagar $15.
And if not, they have to pay
$15
if they lose the day, miss the day.
Una de las cosas que hemos observado también, no observado, sino platicado con los migrantes de México.
People from
Mexico. ¿Cómo hacen ellos para entrar?
How is it that they come across the border?
Y caminan 4 noches a pie, pero solo en la noche.
Sometimes they walk 4 nights through the desert,
but
only at night.
La madre llevando en sus espaldas,
the children will carry
la ropa de
a little bit of clothing
y la comida,
and the
y
food
el agua.
And the water.
Y el padre,
and the father,
cargando hasta
sometimes
dos niños,
carrying even 2 children.
Caminando para cruzar la frontera.
Walking to be able to cross the
y
border.
Y también guiados por un pollero.
And they're guided by a pollero, a guy who's like a smuggler.
Y pagando, parece que $1,000.
And they're paying about $1,000. It's actually between $1,000 and $1,300.
And then 50% of that to the children.
So these people get the money, they borrow the money.
Y a veces cuando viene aquí,
so sometimes when they come here,
la agarran y la deportan otra vez.
Then they're entonces, picked up by the Border Patrol and deported again. So they owe money for the first passing, but then they have to back where they started from.
Estamos viendo este problema y de México que es vecino con Estados Unidos.
And we're seeing this with Mexico, which is a neighbor with the United States.
Y ya de Honduras,
but a Honduran comes all the way up here, who crosses
Guatemala, todo México,
and all of Mexico. If that person is deported, it's a major problem.
Y entonces para nosotros, ya conocimos la realidad del norte,
so we've seen the reality of the north, which is different
de la que se comenta en Honduras,
than what they comment about in Honduras.
What do they do with the children during the day?
They have them in a migrant education program, which is a pretty good program. These are some of the realities that we're up against, and that migrant farm workers are up against, and the closer we've gotten to the people, the more we find ourselves just overwhelmed by all kinds of problems. One week, in one day, I got 3 calls from people whose cars had been impounded and whose family members were in jail because they were driving without a license. And so each of those people, they needed me to go with them to try to get their cars out of impound, and they all had to pay about $100 a piece for to get their cars out. Plus, they needed to try to bail their husbands out of jail, but in every case it was too late because the Border Patrol had already put holds on them, so they were on their way to be deported. Okay, and these were families that were just barely scraping by, that were, in every one of the cases, they were living like 3 families in 1 2-bedroom apartment, just saving as much money as they could. And here, they're picked up, and you know, they're just, since the police works hand in glove with the Border Patrol, you know, they're just shipped off. But the family, the majority of the family members are still in Mount Vernon, you know, still in some apartment, right? And then they have to pay to get their car out in addition to that. You know, then the next week it might be something else, like someone whose car has been taken because someone saw drugs being dealt from the car. And it might have just been some family member or a friend of the family, you know, who drove, and someone who was in the car was dealing drugs, you know, and so that gives the DEA the right to seize that car. You know, so this last week I had two different families that came to me and wanted to know how to get the cars out of, you know, from being seized. And we found out that one of them had warrants out for their arrests for, you know, because they were accused of dealing drugs too. Well, they may not have dealt drugs. In fact, in this case, they hadn't dealt drugs. But they were in the car with someone that was dealing drugs, so they were implicated. And so these two families both fled to Mexico. And they were both people that had legal papers. So they've given up their papers now, you know, and, you know, just messes, you know, day after day after day, just new stuff. And it's very, very difficult sort of work.
How much? Is there any indication at all that the governments of the people who are fleeing their country to come to our country are ever going to improve living conditions so that the folks that live in Mexico could stay there and have a living wage and have some kind of freedom and happiness? There's, is there anything on the horizon at all that you see?
There are movements, you know, grassroots movements that are struggling to improve the lives, you know, for people, but there's just, they're few and far between. I mean, the need is so great for grassroots development projects, and, you know, that's what these guys represent, a grassroots sustainable agricultural program in Honduras. You know, but there's a need for just, I mean, like, for every, like, in our area, there's, like, one department, there's probably 80 villages. Well, we're working in maybe 20 of them. Okay, and that's just in our department in Honduras. Well, for, you know, for, so there's 20 villages, but out of, you know, in the large, I mean, there's thousands of villages in Honduras. And maybe out of, you know, 10,000 villages, there's projects in maybe, 100 villages. You know, and that's just Honduras. In Mexico, it seems like there's far less going on. Even
so the government isn't really doing a thing, is what you're saying?
Well, the government, even if it wanted to, yeah, I mean, the needs are immense, you know. But yeah, the governments, I mean, you know, aren't doing what needs to be done. And USAID has funneling channels, channeling all kinds of money, but a lot of times their projects are completely misguided. And they have other objectives. Their main objective isn't independence, but it's something else, you know. A lot of the funding for development projects that happened in Honduras when we were there in the 80s were projects that were made to create dependency rather than independence, you know, because the U.S. had other, you know, military kind of strategic interests.
Because Honduras was a staging area of the Contra War against the Sandinistas.
Yeah, exactly.
It had done some good for their country.
So, yeah.
But can you speak to how NAFTA has affected Mexico's economy?
You know, NAFTA has opened it, made it possible for big multinationals and for farmers to set up operations across the border. And, you know, and that has provided lots of jobs for people, but the wages are pretty low, you know, very low. I mean, I know I have some people that I know from Honduras that have tried to come here illegally, and they ended up getting kind of scared at the border. And now they're working for one of the maquiladoras in you know, it's like I think it's Ford, you know, auto company or something. And, you know, they're building parts or something, and they're making, you know, probably the daily wage, $20 a day.
No. $20 a la semana.
$20 or $30 a week. Okay, so it's really been in the interest of the big companies much more than in the interest of the people.
The other thing about a lot of the maquilas on the Mexican border, and even some of them farther south, is that they have, this isn't true of all of them, but many of them have really tried to thwart any kind of organizing efforts by keeping people in kind of barracks conditions. There are pregnancy tests for women as soon as they're pregnant, as soon as they're married, as soon as your family tries to come up, as soon as you try to establish any kind of permanency there, you're booted out. And some of them even have 6-month rotating positions. They also tend to recruit from southern Mexico, both because they can pay lower wages and also because of that very factor. By separating people from their family structure, they can also prevent organization around the working conditions.
And I've also read that because of the maquiladoras, there's a migration to where the maquiladoras are, and there isn't the infrastructure to support the amount of people there, and that has resulted in a lot of problems.
Yes. And plus, it gets pushed across the border.
You know, what is really sad to me is that there's a real need for agricultural workers in our country. But the INS, you know, there isn't the political will to sort of make it possible for people to, you know, to work here and to become, you know, work here legally. You know, and so we have all these workers that are just in a very vulnerable place, and yet they're desperate enough, their situation is desperate enough back in Mexico or Central America that they're willing to take all these risks and to come back year after year after year suffering all these difficulties, you know, because it's still worth it for them. I mean, that's amazing to me.
Yeah.
Well, how about the Ford plant or the people that hire them, the farmers or the landowners? Are they in trouble with the law?
Well, there are loopholes that make it possible for growers to hire people if people have some kind of document. And there are many counterfeit document groups. I mean, it's easy to get counterfeit documents for... ¿Cuánto cuesta documentos?
$20,
you can get a fake green card. $80 is a typical amount. So you get a green card, you know, and a social security card, and they're false cards, and you can get a job anywhere, and the grower is required to hire you based on what you show, even though he might know very well that it's a false documentation.
And they raise it, they don't have to pay.
Right, and well, they do, yeah, they do pay Social Security, you know, but all that money goes into our, you know, to the Social Security Department. And there's got to be millions and millions of dollars that is going in, you know, to the IRS and to, you know, somebody's Social Security that no one can ever collect on because the numbers are false. The numbers don't correspond with the names. And
but how about the people that hire them? If they have the right documentation, then they're okay.
Yeah, they're okay. You know, which is, in my opinion, is fine because these people need work and the growers need workers. I mean, I'm not arguing that these growers shouldn't be able to hire these people. You know, but there's the whole system is so much against these people. I mean, they're targeted by the police. You know, commonly they're pulled over. I mean, it's kind of a joke and you know, getting pulled over for a DWM, driving while Mexican. You know, but people do get targeted because, you know, there's racial targeting, which is happening all over the United States. And I've talked to police officers who've admitted that to me, that they're much more likely to do a license plate check on some beat up old car that's got a couple migrant farm workers in it than they are a nicer car with a white person in it.
Wouldn't you like a bus for some of your outreach work?
Well, that would be great. We have a van, but what we'd like is drivers. And volunteers. We need more volunteers. I mean, we're overwhelmed. We could use a number of volunteers to help us pick people up and bring them different places and bring them to our Bible studies and things. I'd like to, before we end up, you know, finishing off, I'd like to be able to end talking a little bit about how we're trying to confront some of these obstacles. You know, no sé, Rocío, si quiere decir algo de cómo estamos enfrentando algunos obstáculos y llevando una buena nueva a la gente. En David también, y ustedes, ¿no? Si quiere decir algo. Couple minutes.
Sí, pues ya les había dicho Tierra Nueva ofrece ayuda a la gente.
We've already said that Tierra Nueva offers help to the people.
Pero no ofrece la ayuda pidiendo que vengan al estudio.
But we don't offer the help saying, come to the Bible study.
Sin ningún condicionamiento.
It's a help without any conditions.
Entonces, la gente va con más confianza.
And so that makes builds the people have more trust.
Y cada vez que entra al o sea, una persona nueva que entra
a Tierra Nueva, and every time a new person comes into our office,
como hay un altar y hay
un altar
tapiz,
there and there's a
pregunta.
There's a wall hanging about, you know, a religious wall hanging, they ask.
Preguntan y pues a veces por ahí uno empieza.
And so when they ask them, then that's when we begin to explain.
Los invita uno al estudio bíblico.
Maybe we'll invite them to a Bible study.
Los o a la oración de mediodía.
Or we'll invite them to the noon prayer.
Hay muchas mujeres que van a la oración de mediodía.
There are many women that come to our prayer at noontime. We have a noontime prayer every day of the week.
Y pues esa es la única manera, es la más común, pues lo que más usamos es ayudar a la gente sin que sin ningún condicionamiento.
And this is mainly what we do, is we offer help to the people without any conditions.
No sé si David y Celio quiere decir algo de cómo cuáles son sus impresiones del ministerio y que cómo se puede servir a esta gente y llevarles una buena nueva.
Una de las vamos a hablar un poquito de las limitaciones. Yo no sé si ya habló Roberto, que es la falta de personal voluntario.
I want to talk about some of the limitations, and one of them is just the lack of volunteer help.
Las necesidades, las solicitudes van creciendo, el número de solicitudes.
The requests are
de
growing.
De diferentes problemas.
About different problems.
Entonces, Roberto creo que solo tiene, solo son cuatro personas.
I think there's only four people that are most, you know, that are working.
Ellos dos, Graciela
Rocio
y otro señor Roberto,
And then Gracie and then another volunteer named Roberto.
Entonces, y tiene un trabajo muy duro.
And it's a very hard job.
Y día a día se va agrandando el número de migrantes.
And day by day the number of immigrants is growing.
Se va agrandando el número de problemas.
So the number of problems are growing.
Una de las cosas que he visto de Tierra Nueva es que tiene un lote de tierra.
One of the things that I see with Tierra Nueva is that they have a piece of land that they borrowed.
Y allí trabajan muchas familias.
There are many families that work.
Y a nosotros nos da mucho gusto de ver.
We have great pleasure to see even the little children out there working.
Hasta los grandes,
even the older people all working, and that's all their product.
Ellos se esmeran en cuidarlo.
And so they're taking care of it.
Entonces, con ello se está logrando la unidad.
So with them we're being able to have some unity.
En ese pequeño lote, digamos que casi colectivo, podríamos decir.
In this small plot, which is really a collective plot.
Allí se van, puede facilitarle un poco el trabajo al ministerio de encontrar muchas personas.
And there it makes it easier for us to meet lots of different
porque
people.
Porque para convocar alguna reunión,
to be able to get a meeting
Roberto,
Rocío
estar llamando, Rosero, Graciela,
Rocio,
y Gracie, donde no hay teléfono,
or calling all these people, we have to go to the people, find where they live and
entonces,
tell them about the meeting.
Es un trabajo duro.
So it's a lot of work to gather the people.
Y la forma de integrar la familia emigrante es una forma buena, va trabajando.
And the way of integrating and bringing in these immigrant families is a good form, you know, bringing them, giving them work like that. Mm-hmm. You know, our work is most directly, you know, sort of ministry of word and sacrament in the jail. And the people that end up in the jail are the people that would be least likely to come to a Bible study, you know, outside the jail. But these people come with such a thirst, you know, that it's just incredible. I mean, you know, I commonly will bring, you know, have people, every Hispanic person in the jail will come to a Bible study. And that includes, you know, second generation farm work people who are speak English as their first language and Spanish as their second language. And then brand new immigrants that are just right out of the migrant camps. You know, and these people, they're usually in a very desperate situation, you know, because they're scared to death and they're ashamed and they don't want their families to know a lot of times about their problem. And sometimes they're even innocent and they don't know how to get out of their problem. You know, but those people, they come to our Bible studies and at first they come with a total expectation that they're going to get a scolding, you know, because that's what they expect from the Bible and from a pastor. You know, but when they hear that God, you know, we take them through the Gospels and really show them that, you know, that, you know, when God came to earth, he came and he went out to where they were. He didn't wait for them to come. You know, Jesus didn't wait for people to come to him. He went out right to where they were, to the Sea of Galilee, to Galilee, you know, to the backwaters, the villages of Israel. And he healed and, you know, he touched people at their point of felt need and without any conditions, you know, usually. The people who were brought to him, he healed and he forgave sins of people that didn't even confess their sins. And, you know, and God took the initiative in Jesus, and we take people through text after text after text, and a lot of people come to faith in the jail. Many people, you know, and it's an exciting sort of place to work. But, you know, and we don't know what happens to a lot of those people once they leave the jail. So we're out there planting, you know, we're sowing the seeds, and uncertain of what's, you know, what's happening. But I've taken many people through steps of, you know, sometimes someone will say, well, I want to be baptized, because some evangelicals back there are telling me I should get rebaptized. And I'll say, well, weren't you baptized as a Catholic? And they'll say, well, yes, but that's not valid, is it? And I'll say, well, you know, we have a tradition where if people are insecure about their baptism, I mean, they can also have a reaffirmation of baptism. Would that interest you? And I explain it to them. And I've taken whole groups of people through a whole catechism, you know, where they've gone through basically a first communion or a catechism class, and we've ended up taking communion and, you know, and kind of having a reaffirmation of baptismal vows. And I offer communion every week. And, you know, it's typical for everyone to just look at me like, what? You know, you're offering us the body of Christ? You know, and one time I had one guy who said, you know, I probably shouldn't take communion, should I? Because I think that I may not be able to resist doing coke, you know, using crack, smoking crack when I get out. Because it's really hard for me to stop using crack. And should I? Probably shouldn't take communion, should I? And I said, well, you know, I took him to Romans chapter 5, and, you know, while we were incapable of saving ourselves, you know, while we were still sinners, Christ died for the ungodly, it says, right? And so we look at that. And so, you know, it seems like you might need communion more than ever if you're having a struggle. And so anyway, that guy's convinced. And the next person says, well, you know, Roberto, what Julio's saying, you know, is that he really doesn't think that he can stop using drugs. And so you should listen to him and not give him communion, because it probably isn't right, is it? And so we repeat the same thing with that guy. Then the third person, well, you know, I was baptized, but I was baptized as a Mormon. I probably shouldn't take communion, should I? You know, and I've gone around where everyone has had some problem like that. And, you know, we end up finally convincing everyone that it's, you know, that it's great. They can take communion, you know. And so they all take communion. And then the next week they come back thirsty for it, you know. And then I, you know, they're there for another month, and then everyone's gone. And I start out with a brand new group, you know. Does anyone have any questions? I think
when they repeat, you say that you have some come back.
Well, some are there longer than others, and there's a turnover, right? So a lot of people come to, you know, get really strong in their faith, and then they end up, I mean, some of them, like one of my objectives is I say, well, you know, all of you guys are going back into your pods, into your cells, and you can bring the good news to people that I can never bring it to. And, you know, God's trying to recruit you to bring the good news to other people.
But you know, I mean, ones who have been in the jail and released, and then they come back, do they come back to the Bible study?
Oh yeah. A lot of times they do, but a lot of times they never come back to our region. And so I never hear about them, and I don't know where they go. Sometimes they go to prison. A lot of times I collect calls, you know, at least, well, probably every day from prisons, you know, around the state of Washington, from inmates that have gone through our jail ministry, and from people in INS detention. You know, I mean, I get them all the time, just day and night, you know, or letters from inmates.
Who runs the camps? Or who the workers are in? Are they state run? Are they farmer run?
They're farmer run.
Are they inspected?
They are. Yeah, they are not.
I mean, for sanitation, that type of thing. I don't know who is or is not.
They are inspected by the health department.
Any, the same problem as Gadget that they have in Yakima County, where a lot of people are not in the camps, they're camping by the river or their home, and camping up in the hills. Like
there's a lot of people
that they've just needed a room.
Not as much, because the climate is, there's too much rain. I think that makes it more difficult, you know, for people to get away with that. I have a letter that I'd like to just close with. I figure we can end by 7:15. If anyone needs to leave, though, feel free to leave. But you know, one of the things that I find most exciting about our ministry is just the theological it's so theologically exciting. There's so much going on in terms of people's questioning. You know, once we get into really dialoguing with people and we've won their trust, the kinds of questions that come up are just are very stimulating. And, you know, one thing about our ministry, and sometimes I feel like quitting. I just get so discouraged. It's so hard sometimes just to see people who you work with just, you know, see signs of hope, and then they end up going back to drugs or selling drugs or using drugs or end up doing some worse crime and in prison or being deported for this or that, and, you know, or just disappearing or coming and then never coming back, or, you know, there's a lot of reasons to be discouraged, but, you know, it's so interesting that it's hard for me, and that's one of the things that kind of keeps me going. This is a letter from a guy who was in solitary confinement who had a bunch of faith questions, and he was in solitary confinement in Walla Walla State Penitentiary. And another guy from our jail ministry who'd been in going to our Bible studies for 6 months in the jail was talking to him from underneath the door of, you know, of the solitary confinement cells, and convinced the guy to call me about his faith questions. And so we began. He began to call me. Calls me every 2 weeks from solitary confinement. They let him out for an hour a day, and he'll call me once every 2 weeks. And now he's writing me. And this is a letter that he wrote. And this gives you an idea of the kind of thinking that people are doing. And this is happening all over the country. You know, in prisons and in jails, this kind of reflection. Because I mean, I've gotten many letters like this. Pastor Roberto, I hope that upon receiving this letter into your hands, you find yourself well with all of your family. And I desire this sincerely, Jose Antonio. Well, okay. Here I am answering. I'm writing. I'm responding to something that I said to you that I would try to write, even though I don't know how to write English, and I can read it a little bit, and speak it very little. Here I am, still in solitary confinement in El Hoyo, in the hole they call it. And I think that I will be here another 6 months. But I know that with the will of God, I will leave soon. And I wanted to tell you that if you that so many people are asking me questions. So many of the other prisoners are asking me questions here. And they're making me look and look, but I don't understand many things about the Word of God. And I want to ask you a few things. You know, this guy, he actually came to faith, you know, with me over the phone, basically. I mean, he just said, how do I find God? You know, what do I do? It's like, here I am, I'm really desperate, and I want God. And so I said, well, read this and pray and, you know, just cry out to God and say, God, come to me here and where, you know, where I am in this jail and meet me. And I gave him some text to read. And anyway, he called me a week later and said that he'd come to faith and he had this conversion. Well, then all of these inmates that were in solitary confinement with him started asking him questions. So he says, like in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 3, it says that I'm going to go and destroy all that you have, to go and destroy everything that the other king has. But let's see. But if God is a God who loves us and it's bad to kill big people, why did God say to kill everybody, even the children and nursing babies? Why would God permit that children and babies be killed? I don't understand this, and I find it very difficult, but maybe it isn't. But anyway, I want somebody who can explain this question to me from the Bible. The Bible also says that when you die, you're asleep. But if you look in Luke chapter 16, verse 19, it speaks about Lazarus and the rich man. When Lazarus and the rich man are dead, the rich man was in hell, or in Hades, and the Bible says that when you die, you're sleeping. Can you explain this to me, or can someone from your church explain these things? These are questions. Forgive me if I am a little bit foolish, but if anyone from your church would be able to answer my questions, or if you can't, because you have so much work, or if you have other things that you have to do, I would really appreciate if you found someone that can respond to me. You know, I am here for killing a person. And this guy's in for 54 years. He's a 22-year-old Mexican guy. He was a farm worker, and he killed someone. I don't know the circumstances, but he was sentenced to 54 years in prison. Okay, so, and now he's been there 2 years, but he's in solitary confinement for 6 months. So he says, I'm here for killing a person, and I have told to my God, let's see. Or I thought to myself that God didn't like me for all the bad that I was and that I am. But I have read in Judges, the history of Samson, how he killed at one time 1,000 people. And another time, in the temple of God, he killed a lot of people. But God forgave him, and I have only killed one person. But before I felt a lot of pain, and I was never tranquil. But now I have a little bit of tranquility. And for this I give thanks to God and Jesus Christ. Me, before, when I was in the other solitary confinement unit, where you do something, where you're placed when you do something even worse, that place is different than the hole, because the cells are more strict than where I am now. And I had 1 hour where I could call. And there, when I was there, I oftentimes called out to Satan. And one day he visited me, but I didn't know that it was him until 2 days afterwards. But I know that it was him. And because I had about 2 weeks where I was calling him, and I made rites to him in my cell, and I worshiped him. But thanks be to God, I reflected in time. And I said to my God that I would never return to call him again. And I would only worship and honor God, the all-powerful one, who would be my God forever. And these are stories that I'm passing, that I'm telling you to pass the time. That happened to me in this time in the past. But I know now that God is with me, and I believe that he died for all of my sins, and that one day he's going to come and he's going to take all of us who trust in him, because it's written in the book of life, all of this. And I believe that in all of this. And I want to ask you, I just beg you, if you can find someone from your church who assists at your church who would be able to explain to me some of these things. I know that you're very busy, but I need somebody who can help me to move ahead and to teach me, and someone who has time to teach me. And so what I want to know is if you can please answer my questions, and these are questions of other prisoners too, that they ask me. And also send me your newspaper that you publish from your church, and I'll be very thankful for this. And with this, I want to say goodbye to you, and may God bless you always and give you much peace and happiness, and to take care of your family and your church. And please pray for the prisoners that are with me here in the prison. And I ask that you would please answer quickly, sincerely, with all of my respect, Jose Antonio. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a guy who's thinking theologically, you know, who's got a lot of heavy questions, and who's in a place where he's sharing them with people, you know, who are asking questions, you know. But it's a desert. I mean, this is the solitary confinement unit of Walla Walla, you know, Washington State Penitentiary. You know, and there are people like that all over the prison system and jails in this country, you know. And it's fun, actually, to be involved, you know, in this kind of discussion with people. So I encourage all of you guys to, if there's a way for you to plug into some, you know, some kind of jail ministry, or, you know, I mean, this is kind of a plug for jail ministry and Hispanic ministries at the same time.